Support for this podcast comes from the UTSA Institute of Texan Cultures, telling stories of Texas history and heritage from diverse cultures that define the state's unique character for over 50 years. Details at texancultures.utsa.edu.
Welcome back to The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. Conspiracy theories, they're not new in the United States. There have always been people who have held beliefs about large organizations or secret companies that are hiding the real truth from the public. These conspiracists nursed ideas about UFO sightings, fake moon landings, political assassinations, and Bigfoot, but now things seem different. Conspiracy theories have gained greater currency in the collective consciousness of Americans, and they are impacting real-world events. Things like questions people are asking, is COVID-19 both a hoax and a viral weapon developed by China? Is George Soros paying all of those protesters in the streets? Was the death of George Floyd staged? Is Russian strongman Vladimir Putin controlling U.S. policy? Well, what's behind all of these conspiracy theories, and what impact are they having on American policymaking? We're going to be talking about that this afternoon. You can call in. What is your favorite conspiracy theory? Do you think we should actually listen to them, that there might be some grain of truth behind them? Or do you think that this is an actual attack on truth itself in the United States? The number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. And you could also email us at thesource@tpr.org. We're joined by Anna Merlin, senior staff writer at Vice and author of Republic of Lies, American Conspiracy Theorist and Their Surprising Rise to Power. Anna Merlin, it's great to have you on The Source.
Thanks for having me. Good to talk to you again.
Good to talk to you. And Adrian LaFrance is here, executive editor of The Atlantic. She wrote the cover story for the recent Shadowland series that explores the power and danger of conspiracy. Adrian LaFrance, great to have you. Sorry about
Thanks
that.
Thanks for having me.
So, Anna Merlin, are we living in a golden age of a highly fertile area of conspiracy theories?
So people have been asking me this since the president was elected. And so I think what we can say broadly is that it's too soon to know whether there are like empirically more conspiracy theories than there have been, but we know that they currently have more currency than they used to, because they are more visible, and they dominate the public discourse more than they did. But we do know broadly in American history, especially, that conspiracy theories tend to crop up at times of social change, upheaval. So the fact that we're talking about them a lot right now is not totally unprecedented by any means.
So Adrian LaFrance, in your writing about QAnon, for The Atlantic, I've never really been able to put my finger on, like, what is this QAnon thing? I mean, and you've kind of brought it into focus a little bit, but can you explain that?
Sure. It's a little complicated in part. I mean, it's just objectively complicated, but also because it sort of borrows from a lot of other conspiracy theories, and it becomes sort of this super conspiracy theory as a result. So the basic premise is that this anonymous figure known as Q, is an intelligence or military insider who has, this person claims, proof that corrupt world leaders are secretly torturing children all over the world and working within the government to do that, and that Donald Trump is ultimately the person who will stop this. And so that's the sort of broad idea, and it's moved along by a person who posts anonymously to these image boards claiming to be Q, and people kind of follow along in real time and try to piece together clues.
And this is something that people think is actually influencing what we're happening right now. They watch the news and they see this as fortifying their belief. Is that it?
Right. So the clues that are posted that the followers call Q drops, these are often really sort of cryptic or almost cliched and will sort of ratchet up tension and division and warn of a coming storm is one of the phrases. And it's vague enough that people kind of can then apply any world event to say Q predicted this. But when you talk to a follower about the specifics, And the number of predictions that have not come to pass, there's sort of always an explanation for why, you know, maybe it was a deliberate misdirection or a clue within a clue. So you very quickly kind of fall down endless rabbit holes with the people who follow this conspiracy theory.
Anna Merlin, is this entertainment? Is that how people see this?
I don't know. I can't speculate on how people who are engaged in these communities think about it. But one thing that we do know is that a lot of times conspiracy communities give people sort of purpose and meaning, and they allow folks to make sense of really big events that can sometimes be hard to parse. You know, especially right now, we're in the middle of a pandemic, we're in the middle of a sort of global uprising over police brutality. And it's just really tempting to find sort of larger narratives that help create meaning. With QAnon specifically, it has allowed supporters of President Trump to sort of predict that they will see this kind of mass justice that he will enact, you know, that all of his enemies will be arrested and put in jail or put on trial. And it's something to kind of look forward to, you know, at a time that is chaotic. So I wouldn't call it entertainment by any means. I would consider it a form of making meaning.
But I'm sure you've experienced this as you interviewed many of these folks. They do exhibit this hyper state of excitement and almost giddiness talking about these. And you can see the dopamine like shooting across their brains as they talk about it. They're definitely getting a positive jolt from, you know, just having these theories to talk about. Anna, have you experienced that?
I have definitely seen, and there are some studies to kind of back this up, that sometimes, so people who believe in conspiracy theories really strongly, people who are in the very deep end of the pool, as I would say, because we all believe in conspiracy theories to some extent, some people are motivated by a feeling of specialness, that having access to this secret inside knowledge can be really intoxicating, and the idea that you know what is going to happen at a time of uncertainty is very exciting. With both Pizzagate and QAnon people who have a lot of shared DNA, who are in some cases, you know, the same people, there is definitely this kind of satisfaction that I have seen at the idea that, you know, soon their opponents will be proven wrong and this, you know, dramatic sort of last day of judgment will be upon us. It does seem exciting. In a way, I don't know what's going on with their dopamine, but it does seem exciting.
Adrienne LaFrance, have you seen hyperstate of arousal from folks who share their QAnon stories?
Absolutely. And I would say it's not necessarily that it's because they're entertained, although maybe that's a byproduct, but really because they really faithfully believe in them. So the thing that surprised me a lot going into reporting my story about QAnon, I wanted to better understand what drew people to this theory specifically, just because it's absurdity and sort of this question of like, well, who, you know, to Anna's point, we understand a little bit about why people are drawn to conspiracy theories broadly, but like, why this one? Like, what is it that is engrossing to people? And I was surprised by how many just sort of true believers I encountered. And it wasn't even just a sense of like arousal or excitement, but more almost like a serenity, like almost something spiritual, I would say.
So do you think there's supernatural elements to QAnon, Adrienne?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it very closely mirrors other sort of either religious or other communities that are preoccupied with the end times. And so, I mean, I think you could look at QAnon, and this is what I wrote in my piece for The Atlantic, is you could look at it through the lens of a baby religion and what it looks like for a 21st century religion to form.
Like kind of like the mutant religion of the Beneath the Planet of the Apes, where they worship the atomic bomb type thing. Well, let's go to
something
a caller.
Like that, yeah.
Let's go to Robert on the phones. Robert, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for having me. I just wanted to say that I definitely agree a lot with what you're saying about people that believe in conspiracy theories, either not being able to understand the truth on an empirical level, so they like to gravitate towards what they can believe rather than know true. And the one that had me going for a while that I had to get my dad off of because it was ridiculous is Nephilim. giants from the Old Testament or the Torah, half angel, half humans, that were killed in Afghanistan and smuggled to a military base in Ohio. And it was ridiculous. It took a lot of effort to prove that that's not true. And I just thought that one was a wild one you guys would enjoy to talk about. And yeah, thank you for your work in trying to stop the soothsayers from selling their poison.
All right, Robert.
Thank you, guys.
Robert, thank you for the call. Anna Merlin, have you heard this conspiracy theory before?
I haven't, but it actually sounds like an updated version of the idea of a golem. You know, a golem, of course, being a folkloric being in Jewish folklore who's believed to be brought back to life out of mud and at a time to sort of like fight its enemies, kind of. Like it sounds very similar to golem folklore kind of brought into a modern conspiracy format. I like that.
But there's myth-type conspiracy theories like that, or Bigfoot or Abominable Snowman. And then there's Pizzagate, where people will, like Adrian LaFrance, you write in your article, an unassuming kind of everyday kind of Joe decides he's going to take his assault weapons and go to Pizzagate and shoot it up. So that's different, isn't it?
Right, it is. And I think one of the things that occurred to me through my reporting was that there are multiple potential tragedies that come from widespread conspiracism. You know, obviously there's this very troubling mass rejection of reason and all of the harmful effects on a functioning democracy that come with widespread distrust in institutions that can be, you know, related to conspiracy thinking. But then, like, to your point, you think about this person, this person otherwise leading an ordinary life who gets sucked in and decides to take matters into his own hands. And then for his reckless action is sent to federal prison. And that's not just, you know, of course the risk to the lives of people in this pizza shop, luckily no one was harmed or killed, but the risk to their lives is frightening. But even what he did to his own life is a tragedy. And so, there's a multi-layered danger associated with conspiracy thinking.
It seems like conspiracy theories today are politically weaponized and are used in a way to dismiss disturbing truths for one side or the other, where one side can say the death of George Floyd was staged, the elderly gentleman who was pushed back and he hurt his head, that was caught on video in the protest, and he's actually a crisis actor for Antifa. And so it doesn't really hold up to truth, but what it does provide people who want to believe it just a way to dismiss out of hand the inconvenience of the actual reality. So this is more than just talking about, you know, giants and things, but real life consequence. Anna Merlin, is that happening?
So it's really important to point out that while the crisis actor claim has been circulating for a while, which is the false claim that people who die in mass casualty events like mass shootings were actually actors and the event was not real and it was staged, crisis actor claims have been circulating for a long time. What we have right now is that the president of the United States has falsely claimed that, for instance, the elderly protester in Buffalo, Martin Gugino, was what he called an Antifa provocateur. So it's not that these claims are new, it's that we have people like the president of the United States promoting them. The idea that he would claim that an elderly man who was attacked by police was, in fact, a provocateur and the attack was staged is really staggering. That is something new, and it's really worrisome.
Your reaction to that, Adrienne LaFrance?
I agree entirely. I think the fact that they're promoted by the person whose restraint is perhaps most important of all to Americans is really troubling. And also at a time when the way the informational system is designed, I mean, the ability for conspiracy theories to spread rapidly across the social web. And, you know, we're still in the very beginning of understanding how the social web has changed the way that people even expect to get information. But that's a huge factor, too, is you have these mega platforms who, even the ones who are occasionally well-intentioned, are simply not taking responsibility for really dangerous misinformation and weaponized conspiracy theories just spreading rapidly across their platforms.
We're talking about conspiracy theories in the U.S. and their impact on politics and policy making and what's happening in the real world, how this is not just an exchange of fantastic stories, but also this is how people are viewing how they view the world. You can call in. The number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. Welcome back to The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. Conspiracy theories continue to gain traction in the U.S. We have a pandemic. We have an economic collapse. We have a political fight going on like we've never seen before. We've got climate change, all sorts of things happening around us all the time. People want to try and make sense of the world. It helps to have a boogeyman. It helps to have a nice, clean little narrative to explain it for you, but that doesn't really reflect reality. And then we have some people who are concocting stories to help them understand the political sphere as well. And you have to wonder, do these conspiracy theories, can they become a clear and present danger to democracy in the United States? What's your take on conspiracy theories? Do you share them? Do you enjoy them? You think they're just funny? Call in. The number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. You can email us at thesource@tpr.org. And we're joined by Anna Merlin, senior staff writer at Vice, author of Republic of Lies, Conspiracy Theorists and Their Surprising Rise to a Power, and Adrienne LaFrance, executive editor of The Atlantic. She wrote the cover story for the recent Shadowland series that explores the power and danger of conspiracy. Anna Merlin, can these conspiracy theories be a clear and present danger to democracy?
I think that we definitely have a situation that a lot of people find worrisome, which is not being able to come together on a shared source of reality, the not being able to agree on the most basic facts. And one specific thing I've been thinking a lot about recently is specifically COVID conspiracy theories, actually, because I think they're one way to kind of illustrate this. You know, medical conspiracy theories have been around for a long time, like the idea that the government is, you know, hiding the cure for cancer. That's a really common one. It's been around for decades. But what we see right now is that conspiracy theories about COVID, specifically about the COVID not being very serious or about it being, you know, some kind of government plot, is actually changing the way that people behave. It's changing people's desire to do things like engage in social distancing or wear masks or take other sort of basic common sense precautions, which can lead to people getting sick. And so I do worry that when we don't have shared sources of information, that we can't sort of come to an agreement about what reality looks like, it leads people to take risks with their own health and that of other people's that, you know, can present a real problem.
Adrienne LaFrance, do you think these conspiracy theories are clear and present danger?
Absolutely. And to Anna's point, we've seen it not just with COVID, but also with the anti-vaccine conspiracy theories. And, you know, I don't know what the actual death toll is from the spread of misinformation about vaccines, but we know that people have died as a result of not having their children vaccinated, and that previously thought to be eradicated illnesses like measles, which once was not endemic in the United States, comes back in pockets because of this. And so there's this public health component. And then again, just this, you know, the fracture of a shared reality and the deep distrust in institutions that keep democracy healthy, those are the two things that are most troubling, in addition to, of course, having a president who promotes conspiracy theories, which is also quite shocking.
One conspiracy theory about COVID is about Bill Gates. And here's a billionaire who has spent millions of dollars trying to find cures for malaria. He's also he has donated a lot of money to try to figure out a way to beat COVID. And so, Anna Merlin, people are saying Bill Gates is behind all this, and then he wants to inject everyone with some sort of tracking device when you come in for your vaccination. And on its face, it's ridiculous. It is just absolutely nuts. But still, you see it passed around on Facebook as like, hey, something to think about. So why Bill Gates? Why this theory?
Yeah, so I've actually been tracking the COVID conspiracy theories since before coronavirus was in the United States, since it first started spreading in China, because it was something that a lot of conspiracy peddlers, people who make their living this way, were very enlivened by early on. So basically, the earliest version of this claim was that the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation predicted coronavirus and that they fund a group who owns the patent to coronavirus, which is not true. None of that is true. The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, though, has funded a lot of research into vaccines, including funding the work of organizations who have looked at vaccines for other types of coronaviruses, not COVID-19. But so basically, the sort of underlying claim here is that coronavirus and coronavirus vaccines are a cover for some kind of global tracking, that a coronavirus vaccine will also implant you with like a microchip used to track your movements and usher in a global government, a new world order, a one world government. These are all probably ideas that sound very familiar to people because they are very old conspiracy theories in a new packaging. And to Adrian's point, one sort of major group that has been promoting these conspiracy theories is the anti-vaccine movement, who have long been really concerned about what they see as untoward levels of government surveillance. So they have really leapt into COVID conspiracy theories and specifically spreading ones about Bill Gates.
Why would they need to implant me with a microchip when me, like almost everyone I know, is willing to carry one around with me? It's a self-monitoring, self-spying device. It doesn't, you know, this, but people don't worry about some things that should be suspicious, but they focus on other things that seem, and that's the selection process seems a little off. Adrian LaFrance, as you write about QAnon, and how closely that is dovetailing with support for Donald Trump. Are there conspiracies about immigration with QAnon?
Within QAnon, there are many, many sort of sub-theories. So you could certainly find any strain of sort of pro-Trump thought or even policy idea contained within the universe of QAnon. But you're right that ultimately, at its core, it's a pro-Trump conspiracy theory. And so it's sort of interesting, like you'll also often see it referred to as a far-right conspiracy, when really it's not far-right in the sense that it is Republican in nature. It is a pro-Trump conspiracy theory. So it's really fundamentally concerned with Trump being this savior figure and everything else sort of revolving around that. So that was a bit of a roundabout way of saying I'm sure within QAnon there are immigration themes, but it's not necessarily central.
And Trump spreading murder conspiracies about the host of the Morning Joe. Why would he do that, Adrian LaFrance?
I wish I could tell you why. I mean, I think ultimately it goes back to the point you made about weaponizing conspiracy thinking for political gain. And so it also is a way of any time that Trump encounters someone within journalism or media who criticizes or disagrees with him, he often doubles down or sort of will just, you know, insult people, in this case, with an outrageous fabrication. But I think it's sort of the classic President Trump playbook where he attacks journalists and he attacks those who say things that don't flatter him.
So in the past, Anna Merlin, did we have some sort of system check that contained conspiracy theories? So before the internet, so they didn't become weaponized and widespread and weren't used to just smear people. And those system checks are now missing and now it's off to the races?
Actually, the best sort of system check on conspiracy theories is having a stable and transparent democracy. One thing that we really know about conspiracy theories is that they flourish, especially in societies where people feel disenfranchised and locked out of systems of power. And so the reason why we see conspiracy theories sort of rising at times of social upheaval is that it's ways for people to respond to conditions that are materially affecting their lives negatively. So all the best evidence we have is that the best system check on conspiracy theories really is to get to the work of creating a stable, transparent democracy, a better social safety net, a better, especially in the United States, a better and more transparent and more easy to access medical and educational system. And when we sort of take care of those things, conspiracy theories kind of take care of themselves.
Right. But it does seem like to get there, it doesn't, I'm not seeing that happening. It seems like they're just going. And they're actually having an impact on policy. They're actually having an impact on polling data and how people will vote. Conspiracy theories about Clinton's emails, which was about nothing, really seemed to take hold. Anna?
Mm. Yeah, I mean, I think that what we do see right now is that a lot of powerful people, up to and including the White House, have really figured out that promoting conspiracy theories about your political and social opponents is really effective. It works really well. And they don't have to have any narrative consistency. You don't have to stick with one. You can just kind of throw whatever at the wall and see what sticks. And it really works in part because it throws fields like journalism into this crisis of having to respond to every new ridiculous claim. And so it can be hard to kind of maintain any like coherence or move forward when you are constantly putting out these fires made of lies and half-truths and mistruths. So especially in the lead up to the 2020 elections, we should definitely be expecting to see more misinformation and more disinformation circulating. Misinformation meaning untruths or lies that are not necessarily active forms of trying to promote a false claim, and disinformation, which is actively trying to promote a false claim. So we're going to see a lot more of both of that, and we should be ready for it because we know how much it impacted the 2016 elections.
We have an email from Sebastian. Conspiracy theories are a reflection on our inability to know. We're talking about conspiracy theories this afternoon. We invite you to call in. What conspiracy theories have you been following? Do you believe in? Do members of your family believe in? What do you think could be done in order to help them understand that this doesn't actually make any sense? You know, the moon landing was not faked. These things... UFOs? Well, I don't know about that. Well, that's for another show. The number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. We'll be right back. Welcome back to The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. We're talking about conspiracy theories in the U.S. Anna Merlin has been writing about them. She's a staff writer at Vice, author of Republic of Lies, American Conspiracy Theorists, and Their Surprising Rise to Power. Anna, why are you focused on conspiracy theorists?
I became focused on conspiracy theories and conspiracy theorists when I realized how widespread they are. The best data we have is that about 1 in 3 Americans believes in at least one conspiracy theory. This is an incredibly sort of common and widespread practice. And it really influences the way that we talk to each other, the way that we see the world, the way that we sort of solve problems. It is also something that we've seen can be really handily weaponized by people in power. And so the fact that conspiracy theories kind of work for everyone, that they work for disenfranchised people, powerless people, and the extremely powerful alike, makes them a really worthy subject of study.
So is there like two types of conspiracy theories? One of them would be like a benign belief, like we could be visited by UFOs, or there are malignant ones that are actually thinking that that QAnon is real?
I actually think it's really hard to divide things that neatly or that cleanly, because any belief can potentially be malignant in the wrong hands, and any belief can potentially be benign as long as it's not leading somebody to negative action against other people, right? But I think we can definitely say that some conspiracy theories cause more harm than others. And definitely what you're pointing out with the UFO movement, a lot of people who believe that alien visitors are coming to Earth believe that those alien visitors are going to show us a better way of life, are going to show us, you know, advanced technologies like anti-aging or free energy or other kinds of technologies that would manifestly improve our lives. And they also believe that aliens are going to, you know, show us a better and more peaceful way to live. So certainly, like, in the lexicon of conspiracy theories, that one is not particularly worrisome and could, in fact, for some people, and some people's lives be a form of positive belief.
Adrienne LaFrance, executive editor of The Atlantic, you wrote the cover story for the recent Shadowland series that explores the power and danger of conspiracy. Why did The Atlantic decide it was important enough to really do a deep dive on conspiracies?
Well, fundamentally, we're concerned with truth just because we're journalists. So there's, for me personally, there's just this sense of when people are discarding evidence or, you know, willfully blind to facts at a large scale, that's concerning. The extent to which they've come to the fore because of the this presidency, also concerning. And and the tech component to me is really big too. I mean, looking at how they're spreading, and you know, Anna made the point earlier about the best sort of bomb for conspiracy thinking is to have a functioning democracy, and I think that's right. But I think that a big part of it is still figuring out as a society how information spreads and what the role of these huge platforms is. So all of those things were sort of swirling in our interest here. And it just felt like the right time to take a big swing at it.
Abraham called in. He left a message saying he wanted to talk about the 5G conspiracy. Anna Merlin, what is that?
So 5G technology has been rolling out across the U.S. and it's been subject to a lot of fears that it is either, again, another tool of government control or else is linked to the spread of coronavirus, both of which are wrong. But we do know that both in the U.S. and in England also, fears about 5G technology have led to people even attacking the workers who are installing 5G technology. Again, This is not super uncommon. Any new technology is usually subject to fears that it's going to be misused by the government. And we understand why that is. We understand fundamentally why people worry about that, because these technologies kind of get rolled out, obviously, without our consent as ordinary people. We sometimes don't feel that we have much power to direct these technologies or how they will be used. But in this particular case, the fact that it is leading to attacks on innocent people just trying to do their jobs is really worrisome.
It's like when they had the Wi-Fi electric meters, they were putting those in, and it could tell the help the power company regulate, you know, the grid. And people were freaking out that this was going to somehow inform the government what cable channel I was watching and spy on me and all these other crazy ideas came out of it. And then eventually it sort of faded away. It's no longer a concern. Every time there's a new technology, people are suspicious. It's natural skepticism. They assign what nefarious motivations to it. And next thing you know, you get yourself a conspiracy theory. Adrienne LaFrance, as you looked at your story about QAnon, and should you think there should be some sort of countermeasures that needs to be put out there to respond to this, or let them just die a natural death?
Well, I mean, I think this is one of the challenging things, which is one hopes that you could just put good information out and that people will be feel compelled to seek facts and to seek evidence. And, you know, anyone who sort of believes in Enlightenment values might imagine that confronting someone who believes these things with facts to discredit these theories might be enough. But just certainly in my reporting, talking to people, that was not the case. And just looking at the continued growth of this conspiracy theory in particular and others, suggests that that's not the case. And so this is where I go back to how people, you know, find their way to these conspiracy theories in the first place, and what responsibility those who make technologies for publishing have to curb the spread of dangerous misinformation. And these are huge, huge problems at scale. I mean, I don't envy Facebook, for example, has 2 billion users. The idea that you would be able to help flag misinformation at that scale is really mind-boggling. But I do think it goes back to how people are coming to these things in the first place.
Let's go to the phones with Lee. Lee, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi. I sort of look at conspiracy theories, people who have them, as having a form of dementia that doesn't necessarily happen with age, but they believe in things that are fantastical, like witch trials and women flying around on boomsticks. You know, people are gullible, You can sell them snake oil, for instance. You can sell them, oh goodness, bleach to cure the COVID virus. It's people who are gullible. I guess that's what I'm trying to think.
All right, Lee, thank you for the call. Anna Merlin, do you see conspiracy theories as just a natural human response to living in chaotic times?
Yeah, I mean, we know that conspiracy theories are also part of our sort of natural tendency to want to question official narratives and question power and call powerful people to account, all of which are like fundamentally good impulses. But what Adrian is talking about with the idea of what big tech platforms feed us, the kind of things that they promote, is a really important point. And the caller's point that conspiracy theories can be used to sell things is also really important. You know, Texas listeners are, of course, extremely familiar with Alex Jones and have been watching his rise for a long time, since the mid-90s. And it's really important to point out that Alex Jones didn't get as wealthy as he apparently is or as widely heard as he apparently is just by promoting conspiracy theories alone. He started selling products. Specifically, he started selling supplements and, you know, water filtration systems because he started, you know, teaching that we were all going to need to purify our own water when the United Nations or the government invaded us. And so even though conspiracy theories are kind of a natural tendency, conspiracy thinking is, it's important to recognize that people can take advantage of that natural tendency and use it for their own gain, use it to make money, use it to widen their public profile, or in the case of big tech platforms, can kind of turn a blind eye to it in order to increase engagement on those platforms and have people spend more time, for instance, clicking through Facebook posts or YouTube videos. So there are a lot of kind of interlocking things going on here that we need to pay attention to.
Adrian LaFrance, on The Atlantic, you write that QAnon could evolve into a religion. What would that look like?
Well, I think it looks like what we're already seeing, frankly. I mean, you see people analyzing these Q drops sort of as like a foundational text. You see this sort of blind faith, this establishment of a kind of holy figure that they're turning to. And so I think a lot of the signals are already there. It's really a question of what it means or looks like to form something religious or like religion in a 21st century setting. So when people are forming communities in geographically disparate ways, perhaps this is exactly what it is.
And Adrian LaFrance, do you think we need to adopt some sort of countermeasures to keep these fantastic conspiracy theories in check that are damaging democracy?
Absolutely. I mean, I think every individual, I hope, would look for evidence to back up the claims that they're seeing rather than quickly reacting with emotion. I mean, Anna made the point that the way that these social platforms are built is to encourage speed and emotional reaction. And I think that that's exactly right. I mean, the entire social web is architected to encourage sort of a not thinking, it's reacting. And so we need to look at how our systems are built. We need to look at how we share information. We need to look at, you know, what politics has become. And certainly at the people who profit off of these kinds of things and those who are victims as a result.
Distrust seems to be very important for conspiracy theories. Anna Merlin, really quick, what can we do to bring back trust?
I mean, again, I think a big way to bring back trust is to create a more just, transparent, and democratic society. You know, but also as journalists, we have a lot of work to do because the last few years have been rife with people in power across the world trying to destabilize our trust in news and in journalism and in sort of provable facts. And so that's going to be one of the biggest projects of the next few years, is figuring out how to get people to read mm-hmm. news again with, you know, a critical eye and an intelligent eye, but without automatically dismissing facts they don't like as fake news.
Anna Merlin is the senior staff writer at Vice. Adrian LaFrance is the executive editor at The Atlantic. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. Thanks for tuning us in.
This has been The Source on Texas Public Radio. The Source is hosted by David Martin Davies, produced by Kim Johnson and Dallas Williams, with production assistance provided by me, Ruben Garcia. Dan Katz is TPR's news director. Support for The Source comes from contributors to the Community Engagement Fund, including the Gladys and Ralph Lazarus Foundation.